area is involved, because it's really important.
A lot of groups who've never signed on to a coalition like this before, environmental groups, so it's very exciting.
Yeah, so you have both the policy level groups like 350 and OEC, and you also have groups that are more activists like Rising Tide. So it's really great to see just such enthusiasm from all across, and many people who are really saying this matters so much that we want to march together in solidarity.
Yeah, thousand friends.
And what I'm really happy to see is that I think this is beginning to spur other activities already, and hopefully those will all be pointed in the right direction.
Okay. So I want to thank all of you. I want to thank Simon Tam of the Oregon Environmental Council for coming in. Thank you, Simon.
Thank you.
And Sandy Polishuk of 350 PDX. Thank you.
A privilege to be here.
And also on the phone, Diane Hodiak, co-organizer of the Central Oregon Climate March. Thank you, Diane.
Thank you, Kathleen.
And this has been Political Perspectives. We are going to continue our morning programming with a related program today. It's an excerpt from Radio EcoShock with host Alex Smith, and he has a segment on how to cope with climate despair, and that is with UK psychotherapist and co-founder of Carbon Conversations, Rosemary Randall. So stay tuned for that. Thanks for listening. And if you missed any of this program, you can hear it later today at kboo.fm.
What if you woke up one morning and realized humans really have changed the world's climate? We show no signs of stopping this unfolding catastrophe. Maybe you already see it and cannot bear knowing. We need help. And a pioneering psychotherapist from Britain says we can help each other. Starting in 2005, Rosemary Randall was part of a team founding a movement called Carbon Conversations. We'll have a conversation with her now. Rosemary Randall, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
I'm glad to connect with you. And please tell us about Carbon Conversations. What are they?
Carbon Conversations are small groups, six or eight people, who meet with two trained facilitators, people who are skilled in helping a group to work together. They're groups which draw on understandings which come from group psychotherapy, but they're not actually therapy. They use those insights to help people talk about problems which are painful and difficult, which they would like to discuss but find hard to face. So in this case, the problem that people come together to talk about is climate change and carbon reduction. And we started these groups because what I found was that when I talked to people about climate change, they were maybe kind of interested in it, they wanted to know a little bit more, you reached a kind of cutoff point where they started to talk about what they could actually do themselves. And I discovered two things. One was that there was a lot of ignorance about what would actually make a difference, and that when people did understand what might make a difference, their reactions tended to be ones of, well, I can't do that. That's too difficult. I couldn't possibly. That's not for me. I don't see why I should. And things of this kind, things which actually turned away from the problem, again, sometimes because these brought up threats to their identity, threats to their way of life, uncomfortable negotiations to be had with family or friends. And so I started to feel that there was a need for a kind of space where people could begin to both get the understanding that they needed about what would make a difference, but also talk about how it felt to consider making major changes to your life that would align it with what the environment needs. And to talk about why we're doing it, to talk about the very seriousness of the situation we face, which I think is another reason why people often turn away from doing something about it, because they feel every time I take some small action, it just reminds me of why I'm doing it, and that's just so upsetting, I don't want to carry on.
So six or eight people might meet regularly in a room and just talk it through?
We meet for six meetings, so these groups are time-limited, and we follow a program of looking at the different areas of your carbon emissions and the big issues around climate change. And we talk about what it feels to think about, well, you might make a load of changes to your home, very personal thing, how you have your home. And we talk about what it might mean if you decide that you're not going to fly again, or if you're going to give up your car use, or you're going to try and reduce it. We look at what you do with your food. What would it mean if you decided that you were going to eat a lot less meat, for example? And we look at all the rest of your consumption. What would it mean to live a much lower consumption lifestyle? And there are a lot of complicated issues in there, which have a lot of personal ramifications for people. And so those are the things which we begin to talk about. Because often there's feelings of loss involved. There's grief. There's a feeling of having been let down by government. There are feelings of being very small and what difference can I make? And I think that it's only when these things begin to be talked about that people begin to be able to feel that they may have the support that will enable them to take difficult decisions in their own personal lives. You know, we hope that government are going to act. We hope that policies will change. That's only part of the picture. Our lives have to change as well.
And how do these people who are worried about climate change find each other in order to form the groups?
Initially, when I started this in Cambridge in England, we started a small voluntary organization. And across the UK, there are a lot of small voluntary organizations working on climate change, community groups like the Transition Town groups, which you may have come across, and other groups. They call themselves things like, you know, such and such climate change action group or whatever. So those groups are gathering members together, and often they're looking for ways to work with those members, ways of supporting and helping people. And that's where these carbon conversations groups come in. They're one of the things which a group like that might choose to do. And we're also using the groups increasingly in workplaces where we have big organizations sometimes who are wanting to do something to become more sustainable. They maybe got government targets to meet and they've realized that they need to have their employees on board. And so we've been offering these groups as a tool which people can use within workplaces as well. And the reason that they seem to work is that they are not just talking about, well, you should do this and you should do that, or here are the top 10 tips to reduce your impact on the climate. They're actually talking about what it means in your life to be thinking about these issues and to be trying to do something about it, and what it means to actually maybe take actions that make you stand out against your friends or your family or colleagues.
So, Rosemary Randall, let's talk about loss. What do people say they fear or experience as climate change unfolds?
I think that very often people don't talk very much about loss. I think that it's something which emerges as you start to create a space that feels safe enough to talk about it. So very often in these groups, it may be the second or third meeting before somebody really mentions loss. And sometimes it may be about something quite funny or something a little bit surprising. Because although I think everybody will have these serious conversations where they will talk about the way that they notice things changing, they notice things which are different. Older people will say, well, there don't seem to be so many birds in my garden. I'm aware of this and I feel very sad about it. So people will begin to talk about those sorts of losses. But they will also begin to talk about being confronted with loss as they try to make a transition. And so somebody in a group recently said to me, in astonishment, because she hadn't realized that dairy produce has a very, very high impact on the environment. And she said, what? No cheese? I can't eat cheese. I'm really upset. That's a loss for me. And she was laughing. But she was also quite serious because she was thinking, well, I really like this stuff, this cheese. It is a loss. And it was kind of like to be given permission to say that she didn't really want to give up cheese. She was kind of fighting it. And she needed to come to some negotiation, some accommodation, like less cheese. But in experiencing something very small like that as loss, I think allows you to go past it. So there are the big losses, which I think we see in climate change when we think about loss of species and loss of habitat and loss of many of the very, very deeply beautiful and sustaining things about our world. And there are the kind of day-to-day losses that we might face when we decide that we're going to keep the house a few degrees cooler, or we're going to say no to the hen night in Prague, or we're going to maybe not buy quite so many new clothes this year. Whatever it is, there are those losses too, and they need to be worked through.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest from the UK, psychotherapist Rosemary Randall. Ro, a listener sent me a link to a really important paper you wrote in 2009. It's titled Loss and Climate Change, The Cost of Parallel Narratives. That's posted at conservation-economy.org. I'll put a link to it in my own show blog at ecoshock.info. Can you explain what you mean by the danger of parallel narratives about climate change?
I wrote this paper at a point at which I was very, very struck by the way in which, when climate change itself was talked about, it was in terms of catastrophe. It was melting ice caps. It was hugely rising sea levels. It was New York being underwater. It was kind of act now or we face disaster. And this was a very powerful narrative which I was hearing sometimes from government and sometimes from environmental organizations, as if by telling us more and more and more about the catastrophe, we would wake up and do something. And parallel to that, I was noticing that when people said, well, what do I do then? That the things which they were asking to do were being asked to do were absolutely minimal. It was like, well, perhaps you could change a couple of light bulbs. And I identified a number of different narratives which I thought were being used, which I gave a number of different names to. One was this idea of the small steps, or just do something little. The other was the idea that we would pass seamlessly from our current way of life into a new one. Third one was the idea that technology will save us. You don't need to do anything because the professors are going to sort it out with their magic. And another one was the idea that actually there was going to be changes, but we were going to feel fine about it. It was going to be a much happier way of life. And I felt that none of these narratives were commensurate with the disaster stories that we were hearing. And what it felt to me was as if, in a way, we had created these opposites, this sort of terrifying world in the future and this bland and reassuring one now. And so that all the losses had been pushed into the future as a sort of what if. This will happen if you don't act. And all the things that would actually stop it, the big things that would stop it, that we might need to take responsibility, had been eliminated from the picture. And so we had these sort of parallel tracks which didn't really connect. And I came to think that the connecting factor was about loss, that the fact is that dealing with climate change involves us giving up the way of life that we currently have. And nobody was really prepared to say that. But actually, we live utterly unsustainable lives. We have to start taking them apart now, and we're probably not going to like having to do it. And, you know, most people will kick at that. And so I felt that if you do actually start to make those changes, it turns out to be not as bad as you thought. You can manage those transitions. You can let go of the things which you have wanted and which you have enjoyed, but which really no longer deserve a place in life. And so I felt that we needed somehow to look at models which helped us understand what the process of going through a loss and coming to terms with it actually is.
Well, I think, you know, millions of people are quietly realizing the weather has changed. They may see that the robins or a finch doesn't come back. And just like your cheese incident there, it strikes them. Well, then we might have a first stage of a personal crisis of realization. How can we deal with that?
Okay, so one of the things I think that happens in the model which I use in this paper, which I take from William Morden, is that the first reaction to a loss is to say, it can't be true. Perhaps the robin's just hiding. Perhaps it's going to come tomorrow. Things like that. Or you can deny the meaning of the loss. You can say to yourself, well, there aren't any robins in the garden, but that doesn't necessarily mean that everything's gone wrong. It's just a variable year. Or you can say to yourself, you can deny that the loss is irreversible. You can say to yourself, well, there aren't any robins, but I'm sure there'll be some robins next year. And so you can kind of hold yourself away from it. And the difficult thing, I think, the first thing you have to do is actually say, no, actually, there isn't a robin in the garden this year. And it is probably something to do with the loss of biodiversity, because I do know that the population of robins is plummeting, or whatever it is. And first of all, you have to accept that idea intellectually. You know, it's a fact. And then in a way, you have to begin to accept it emotionally. You have to say, well, actually, I care about this. It matters to me. And I think a lot of people get stuck is in this first area of denial, which I think you'll notice is not really like the denial when we talk about the denial of a climate change skeptic or somebody who just says, oh, climate change ain't happening. This is a very ordinary form of denial that probably most of us are engaged in at one level or another because the facts are so painful. It's just very, you know, in a way, it's very normal to try to hide in those places. And coming through that, I think, what William Warden talks about is he talks about really these two paths through grief. He talks about the tasks of grief. And you can either, in a way, work through these painful emotions. You can realize that you feel grief. You can have moments of despair. You can feel afraid. You may feel very guilty about the way that you feel at fault because of it. You may feel sad. You may yearn for the things which are lost. You may feel that your life is very confused and so on. And you can come out of that into a new adjustment in which you feel that you've got new skills and you develop a changed sense of self and you can reinvest your emotional energy. And that's the positive pathway through grief that he talks about. And he talks about it in a way not as a complete and ever finished process. You know, you have kind of all sorts of setbacks. But what he identifies as what he calls the negative of that process is a state where, because this feels so painful, you shut off all emotion. You maybe idealize what is lost. You try to numb the pain, maybe through alcohol or drugs or manic activity. And one of the manic activities which you might indulge in, for instance, is going shopping. Lots and lots of going shopping, for example. And you don't adapt to the changed situation that you find yourself in. And the longer-term outcome of that is bitterness, anger, depression, withdrawal, and a sense of turning away from life. I think it's quite a useful model for thinking about what we maybe need to go through, because it offers us a way of understanding the different places that people may be at, and then perhaps allows us to have sympathy for those experiences.
Well, listeners, I want to tell you that you can find Rosemary's adaptation of William Warden and others in that article, Loss and Climate Change, The Cost of Parallel Narratives, on page 8. And there's a chart of 4 stages with the possibility of successful coping or destructive failure at each stage. But Rosemary, I can't tell you how many friends and listeners have fallen back on the model of coping with the ultimate loss of death developed by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. Does that work well for the end of a loved and stable climate?
I think the use of Kubler-Ross is really interesting. She was such a pioneer. Her work was mainly with people who were themselves dying. And so the loss that they faced was the loss of their own life. And coming to terms with that and its finality and the little tiny amount of time that you have left. And she was a terrific person because she opened up the possibility of talking about things which had been unspeakable. But I think where William Warden's work is important is that he draws on the work of other people like Colin Murray Parks and John Bowlby to actually look at the experience of loss when you are going to carry on living and you are losing somebody else who is dear to you, or you are losing something else that you will not have back. And so I think it's kind of helpful in looking at things which we might also think of as transitions. In some ways, life is full of little losses. Somebody once referred to the death of a pet as one of life's little rehearsals, in that it kind of prepares you for bigger and harder losses later on. So that whether you're looking at the transition from, say, childhood into adolescence or from middle age into old age, there you're sometimes looking at letting go of something in order to move forward. Or in the cases of the loss of somebody you've loved in life, you're looking at how you're going to cope with the new situation. And I think in Kubler-Ross's model, because Kubler-Ross's model ends with death, and I think for us, we're looking hopefully at moving on and being able to do more. So I think that's why I started using William Warden's model. I felt it had more hope in it.
Well, that makes a lot of sense to me. You know, we have the guilt of our own participation in damaging the atmosphere, but now I feel like I'm experiencing a new wrinkle. When I feel down or discouraged, I ask myself, am I just assimilating this awful truth about climate change? It's almost like that fear of nuclear destruction that I grew up with during the Cold War. Do you see a parallel between climate fear and nuclear fear?
I do. I think that. I mean, I think that's very perceptive. I think that they both produce this huge anxiety that, because it hangs over you, and you can go through big chunks of the day, I think, sometimes carrying on just as normal. I think just as in those experiences of the nuclear threat, a lot of the time nothing seemed very different, and then you'd kind of wake up in the middle of the night, or you'd catch something in the newspaper, and it would just kind of grab you in the guts that everything could come to an end with a sort of terrible, terrible finality. And I think sometimes there are so many unknowns about climate change. We know that it's happening, but we don't know exactly how it's going to work out. It's very difficult for anybody to tell us. It's a situation which makes people feel very, very unsafe. I do think there is a parallel there, which for me, I think it comes down to trying to find the things which will make me feel okay about living day to day, enjoying the things which still matter, whether it's, you know, a hug from a child, or whether it's planting the first seeds in my garden, whether it's just looking up at the sky, or looking out of my window at the moment and seeing two pigeons doing acrobatics on my bird table. They're much too big for it, so they're really quite funny. Holding on to some of those things in the face of fear and grief, I think, is really important.
Well, now, as for yourself, Rosemary Randall, you've moved on from the movement you helped found, Carbon Conversations. What are you doing now?
Well, I'm actually still working with Carbon Conversations. The little organization in Cambridge, which I set up to work on environmental issues, that I have moved on from. But the national organization, which is supporting Carbon Conversations, I'm still involved with. I'm still training facilitators. I'm involved with another grouping in the UK called the Climate Psychology Alliance, which is trying to work more widely with bringing psychological understanding into work on climate change, really just trying to work with whoever we can around why this is actually such a painful and difficult experience. No one likes to hear bad news, and sadly, an awful lot of climate change is bad news. So I think that psychology has a lot to say about it.
Well, as we wrap up, I'd like to ask you maybe the impossible. I feel like I've caused some Radio Ecoshock listeners to worry. I've been the bearer of some really bad news about the Arctic and deserts and storms. I'm wondering, can you offer us one or two good tips to cope, to keep going?
I think one of the things which has mattered most to me is knowing who I speak to about these things and how I talk about it. And to know that there are people in my life who I share this with, to know that I'm not the only person who goes through times of often very black despair about what is happening. And I think knowing also that I'm one person and I'm doing what I can, and to value what I do, and to feel that even if we don't succeed in the way that I wish we could, that it's a question of ethics. It's a question of living the life that I want to lead, leading the life that I think I should lead, the life that feels an ethical life to me. So I think in some ways where I find strength is in part coming back to those core values that I hold that matter to me. I would do this anyway, regardless of whether we're going to succeed or not. And for me, that's very important. And the other thing is to do it with others. To do it in the company of others with whom you can talk, with whom you can say, I'm having a very bad day about this today. What should we do about it? And to find myself also, I think, often outside, in touch with the rest of the natural world. Today I happen to be laughing at the pigeons, but another day it might be that I'm out for a walk, I've gone to the sea, I'm just staring up at the way the clouds form patterns, and I can find a sense of peace again.
Yes, I find myself talking to trees occasionally. I'm not sure how good that is, but it works for me. Well, our guest has been the British psychotherapist and co-founder of the carbon conservation movement, Rosemary Randall. Find out more at carbonconversations.org, and you can follow Ro Randall at her blog at rorandall.org, and that's R-O, and there's two L's in Randall. Rosemary, thank you so much for helping us out today.
Great to talk to you, Alex. Thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Good morning. It's about 9:57. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Earlier, we heard a segment of Radio EcoShock with the guest Rosemary Randall speaking about climate, surviving the climate crisis. Coming right up, we'll hear Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre at 10:15. We'll hear Flashpoints, continuing today a multi-part investigative series on Lyme disease, with an interview with Lyme activist and psychologist Dr. Jessica Bernstein, and War and More War host Dennis Bernstein talks to media activist and anti-warrior Norman Solomon about war and whistleblowers. At 11 o'clock, we'll have the food show. Today's Sam Fromarts, a writer and sometimes baker, talks about his book In Search of the Perfect Loaf. We also speak with Lisa Migrant, the owner and culinary director at Raven and Rose, about using the whole plant. And we talk with Liz Kane, who recently released the second edition of The Food Lover's Guide to Portland. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, and we have a few announcements. Let's go to those, and then stay tuned for Air Cascadia coming up right at the top of the hour.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the PDX People's Climate March on Sunday, September 21st. Gathering will begin at 3 p.m. at the Park Bowl of Tomoko Waterfront, just south of the Hawthorne Bridge. World leaders are gathering in New York City for a UN summit on climate change, and across the country, people will be out in the streets to demand a better world for ourselves and for generations to come. Again, that's the People's Climate March on Sunday, September 21st at 3 p.m. at Tom McCall Waterfront Park in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Portland Veg Fest, Saturday, September 27th and Sunday, September 28th from 10 to 6 p.m. at the Oregon Convention Center in Portland. Portland Veg Fest, Oregon's largest vegan food and lifestyle event, offers resources, entertainment, and community building to celebrate sustainable, healthy, and compassionate food choices. Speakers this year include author Dr. Joel Furman, pastry chef Fran, and the author of the Paleo Vegan Cookbook, Ellen Jaffe Jones. Again, that's the Portland Veg Fest, Saturday, September 27th and Sunday, September 28th at the Oregon Convention Center, 777 Northeast MLK Jr. Boulevard in Portland. More can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Wednesday, September 17th, 2014, and you're listening to your community radio, KBOO Portland, at 90.7 FM and kboo.fm on the web. This morning, we're going to be speaking again with Janet Fellin. She has another piece out on Israel and the U.S. and that complicated relationship, which is set to pretty much self-destruct and maybe take other nations along with it. Right now, Israel's control